From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, March 3rd, 2017. And on this day, teachers and school administrators speak up against Governor Paul LePage's school spending plan and why the state wants to build a barge service between here and New York. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
Scores of teachers and school administrators spoke out today in Augusta against Governor Paul LePage's school funding plan. They say it doesn't provide enough money overall, and they also take issue with the governor's effort to rewrite the formula for how money is allocated to local districts. Mal Leary has more.
LePage is proposing that the state provide $991 million to schools for the budget year starting in July. That's $20 million less than this year. He's also floating dozens of changes in how the school funding formula works.
Any number of the 48 proposed changes to the essential programs and services funding formula would have a significantly negative impact on our public schools.
Stan Cowan, chairman of the MSAD 60 school board in the Berwick area, was among those who turned out for the day-long hearing before the Education and Appropriations Committees.
The most devastating proposal calls for the elimination of funding allocations for school system administration.
Cowan says those additional costs for administration will force cities and towns to raise property taxes or cut school programs. LePage is also proposing changes in the way funds for special education are distributed and wants to reduce support for pre-kindergarten programs. Lucy Tucker, who serves on the Falmouth School Board, says the overall plan would directly affect local property owners.
Should the proposed budget pass, residents in our economically diverse community will need to vote and support a significant local property tax increase just to keep the instructional programs intact.
And small rural schools also say some of the formula changes will hit them hard. Heather Wyman of Appleton says the district has struggled financially in recent years, and she fears the situation could get worse under the governor's plan.
Ultimately, by removing educational programming for our students, we were able to pass a budget and keep our school open. But as funding challenges mount, I fear for the future of our small school.
Several teachers also testified that the reduction in funding and changes in distribution would affect their ability to teach. Bangor School Superintendent Betsy Webb, the president-elect of the Maine Superintendents Association, says that while there are some good elements to the budget, it doesn't address the need to improve educational opportunities for Maine students.
We oppose the governor's budget not because we dislike all that it contains, but because it does not represent a coherent or adequately funded plan for educating Maine students.
The Education Committee will now tackle the governor's proposals and make recommendations to the Appropriations Committee, which has indicated that it would like to find some additional funding for schools. But that's a discussion that will likely wait until late in the budget negotiating process. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
President Trump told Congress this week that he wants to see $1 trillion spent on the nation's infrastructure through an unspecified public-private partnership. Now states, including Maine, are putting down markers for where they see the biggest needs. As Fred Bever reports, Maine's to-do list includes a plan for a new barge service between here and New York.
The National Governors Association submitted its members' wish lists to the Trump administration last week. The overall list isn't being made public, but Maine's Department of Transportation is releasing its proposal, almost $500 million, for improving the state's roads and bridges, and to jumpstart a project that will revive a long-dormant coastal barge route from Maine to New York City. DOT spokesman Ted Talbot says State Transportation Commissioner David Bernhardt met this week in Washington with federal officials and the state's congressional delegation, in part to talk up Maine's infrastructure needs. Although Talbot says the state does want to maintain control over exactly how its federal allotments are spent.
He met with the U.S. DOT Transportation Secretary Chow, and that list, while not overly project-specific, is really more about stabilizing our funding.
The barge project, dubbed the New England Marine Highway, is being led by the Port Authority of Maine to include the construction of two hybrid tugboat-driven barges to bring high-volume, low-margin freight, such as wood chips and bottled water, from Maine to markets south of here. Authority Executive Director John Henshaw says that as the shipping industry moves to deployment of mega ships that need to quickly offload as many as 8,000 cargo containers at the few ports big enough to handle them, new opportunities are opening for more nimble regional barge service.
We've been working closely with the Port Authority in New York, New Jersey on this project for quite some time, and they're very interested in the concept because they're facing increasing pressures to move containers out of the port quickly based on these larger vessels that they're calling.
Henshaw says the project would include $135 million in public funds and tens of millions more pledged by Eimskip, the Iceland-based shipping company that's made Portland its U.S. port, and New York-based tugboat company McAllister Towing and Transportation. President Trump this week said he wants to foster joint public-private infrastructure investments, although it's not clear yet what financial models he is considering. More details could emerge later this month. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
Unless you yourself are a hermit, there is a good chance you know about Chris Knight. Knight, better known as the North Pond Hermit, lived alone in the woods in the Belgrade Lakes area for 27 years, stealing what he needed before he was discovered and arrested in 2013. His story attracted tremendous attention from media all over the world. For some, he was a folk hero. For others, a thief who made them feel unsafe and unsettled. And for still others, he was an object of pity. For Michael Finkel, one thing stuck out. Over his 2.5 decades outdoors, Knight stole thousands of books. Knight refused to speak to reporters after his arrest, but when Finkel, a writer, wrote him a letter, he responded, and the two ended up writing back and forth about books and meeting several times during and then once after his time in jail. Finkel's new book on Chris Knight is The Stranger in the Woods. I spoke to Michael Finkel via Skype. I began by asking him about people's reactions to the North Pond Hermit.
There were as many opinions as there were people. I spoke to at least 40 families that own cabins around North Pond, which is in central Maine. And the opinions ranged from complete understanding, if not jealousy, to the very other end of the spectrum where people hid in the dark with their weapons drawn, ready to capture this guy who and wanted him, once he was captured, to possibly spend the rest of his life in jail because he had broken into their house. And none of those opinions are wrong.
There was, though, this sort of, it seems, profound feeling of kind of unease in the areas around because people thought that they were going crazy. They didn't know if this was real or fake. And it seemed like after he was arrested that people were a bit giddy.
It's almost impossible to overstate how long this legend sort of built up. They named this thing, this character, this person. They didn't know what. The people who, there were about 200 cabins around North and Little North Ponds. And for years, decades, there'd been these mysterious break-ins. And people were baffled. Some people thought they were losing their minds. Like maybe they forgot to buy batteries. Maybe they didn't put the steak in the fridge. There was nobody who thought there could really be a person that lived in the woods for all this time. And so once Chris Knight was captured, there was a sense of relief that their houses would no longer be broken into. But really the overwhelming sentiment was further disbelief that this legend was real. It'd be like the Loch Ness monster just decides one day to stroll out of Loch Ness and after all these years there actually was a monster there. It was similar to that. People were more startled by the truth than they were by this myth.
In real life, what do we actually know about Chris Knight with regard to a mental or psychiatric condition? Wasn't part of his court settlement that he had to undergo counseling?
He was examined by a state psychologist who determined that he possibly has one of three syndromes, which one would be Asperger's, which is a form of autism. One would be depression. And the third would be something called a schizoid personality disorder. But really, there is no perfect fit for a diagnosis. And in fact, it seemed that, and I don't want to hit anyone too hard with this, but really the more time I spent with Chris Knight, and then I would leave my conversations with him and immediately turn on my phone and be inundated with noise. And there was the hint that it wasn't Chris Knight who's a little crazy. It's possibly the rest of us.
You mentioned the thing that sort of got you on this was the fact that he collected so many books and he read so much. I imagine you're not the only one who has sort of a thing that got them about this, that made them fascinated by this guy. What other things did people tell you about?
Everybody had a different point of disbelief. One was, how is it possible that this man didn't freeze to death, perhaps during the great ice storm of 1998? How is it possible that this man could go 27 years without seeing a doctor? How is that possible? How is it possible that a man could go 27 years without speaking to someone, and yet suddenly his voice works perfectly fine? He doesn't have any lack of vocabulary. Everyone had a different point of disbelief. And in talking to Chris Knight, he answered all of those questions in a way that made complete sense. And there's not a shred of evidence that he didn't do what he said. In fact, almost everyone who's met him, including the two police officers that arrested him, found him not only to be honest, but almost incapable of lying.
Now, for people who may not know, you are known and you've written about this, so it's not a secret, for having been let go by the New York Times for writing a story that turned out to not be factually accurate. You used a composite. And with this story, you are the only journalist that Chris Knight talked to, and much of what's in the book is based on conversations between the two of you. So let me ask you, I'm sure you were expecting to be challenged on this. How did you prepare for that?
It was essential to me, not only because of my history as a journalist, but also because this story demands it to be as factually accurate as humanly possible. I was allowed to take notes while I interviewed Chris Knight. I hired not one, but two professional fact checkers. Now, I'm human. It's possible that there's a mistake in here, but this story, to the best of my abilities, is completely true.
Michael Finkel is the author of The Stranger in the Woods, about the North Pond Hermit. Thank you so much, Michael, for talking with me.
Thank you.
And you can hear a longer version of this interview at mainpublic.org. And Michael Finkel will be our guest on Maine Calling this coming Tuesday. And you can see the documentary film The Hermit on Maine Public Television this coming Thursday night. And next Saturday, the 18th, there is more information at mainpublic.org. Every year in Maine, about 1,200 immigrants from all over the world are naturalized as U.S. citizens. It's a complicated process that takes years to meet residency and language requirements, undergo an official interview, study U.S. government and history, and pass a citizenship exam. The criteria for applicants and the oath of allegiance they declare are often left out of political discussions about immigration. This morning at the University of Southern Maine, 54 Maine residents representing 26 countries became U.S. citizens. Susan Sharon has more.
Just like every American family, each one of these immigrants has a story about the journey to this country. For 27-year-old Aikuna Vishi of Albania, it was a matter of winning the lottery, not for money or prizes, but a lottery offered by the State Department for citizenship in the U.S.
So I moved here like 6 years ago, and finally, today is a big day of so much waiting.
So much waiting because Vishi says ever since she can remember, she's wanted to get to America.
I love my birth country. I love it. But it's such a small country and we don't have a lot of opportunities. And we see America as a place where our dreams can be true.
Vishi works in her cousin's restaurant in Lewiston and has a 10-month-old daughter and a fiancé who is working on his master's degree abroad. They hope to be reunited later this year. In the meantime, she says she considers herself and her daughter extremely fortunate.
I have like no words to describe how lucky and how powerful all this feels, to me at least.
If you could raise your right hands, and you will be repeating after me. I hereby declare, on oath.
In a packed auditorium at the University of Southern Maine, Sally Blovelt, the field office director for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, administered the oath of allegiance to Vishi and 53 other immigrants from countries as diverse as Jamaica, Thailand, Chile, Ethiopia, and Sudan, as students, family, and friends looked on. Among other things, candidates for citizenship must pledge to defend the Constitution and laws of the U.S. and to bear arms on behalf of the nation when required by the law.
Congratulations, you are now U.S. citizens.
USM President Glenn Cummings was the first to officially welcome the new citizens to what he says remains the greatest country on earth.
Well, I want to tell you that we're not great because we have a big military. We're not great because we have great corporations, lots of business. And we're not great because the new executive officer in the White House says we're going to be great. We're already great because of our ideals.
Among those ideals, says Hazel Kayal, is the right to speak freely, to practice religion freely, and to choose who governs you. Kayal came to the U.S. with her family from Syria at the age of 7. She's now 25 and works as a civil engineer in Portland. Despite the recent anti-Muslim and anti-immigration rhetoric that critics say is coming from the White House, Kayal says she's come to believe that her fellow Americans have her back.
I've been getting messages from my friends, people I don't know, that just say, we're here for you, we're here to be with you, we'll protest with you. There's people that have donated money to our local mosque without a name on it, and they just say, we're here for you, you're our neighbors.
For Kayal, standing up to defend such ideals is democracy at work, and it's why she says she's so proud to be a U.S. citizen. For Ibrahim Hassan, a truck driver from Somalia, it's more than a matter of pride. He says now that he has his citizenship, he can help out those who are less fortunate in his home country.
My plan is I got to build a lot of schools in over there. There's a lot of orphan children over there, and I got to help them out. They didn't get the chance to come here or another country, so I got the chance to come to America. I can give back something.
He'll also be doing everything he can to support his new country, he says, a country that has made giving back possible. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine, Friday, March 3rd, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty. Have a great weekend.